Good morning, early birds. You've caught the Weekend Worm, a special edition that recaps the top stories of the week. A heads up on what we think the newsroom might be following as we move ahead. It is the fourth and final week of February 2026, Saturday and Sunday, the 21st and 22nd. Cold Saturday and Sunday. If you're lucky, the highs will be in the 30s somewhere overnight, dropping down close to zero Saturday, and in the 20s on Sunday. Highs Monday up into the 50s under mostly cloudy conditions, and overnight down around 40. Obviously, the weather continues to be in the news. Blackfeet tribal officials earlier this week declared a state of emergency due to extreme winter temperatures impacting the region. The Blackfeet Tribal Business Council opened a warming shelter where residents were able to access warm meals, drinks, and a place to rest. The sudden shifts in weather is affecting snowpack, and backcountry snow enthusiasts are being urged to be extra vigilant in what's being described as very unstable snow conditions in western Montana. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien filed the report this week.
The Flathead Avalanche Center in Hungry Horse says recreationists have reported four accidental slides in the past week. People have been caught, carried, and partially or fully buried. No injuries or fatalities have been reported. The Avalanche Center says the weight of a person or snowmobile on or near weak snow layers can trigger slabs, even from far away. A special avalanche bulletin is in effect through Sunday morning. It applies to the Whitefish, Swan, Flathead, and Apgar ranges and the Lake McDonald and Marias Pass areas in Glacier National Park. People planning backcountry trips are urged to avoid steep northern slopes. Also, steer clear of steep slopes above gullies, creek beds, tree stands, and cliffs. The West Central Montana Avalanche Foundation's most recent update on Thursday reports considerable avalanche danger throughout the region in the middle and upper elevations. Fresh, wind-driven snow is overloading weaker layers in the snowpack. People are advised to avoid suspect slopes over 30 degrees. Reporting from Missoula, I'm Edward O'Brien.
Laurel residents have been raising concerns about city and state transparency in selecting Laurel for a new facility that will treat criminal defendants before they stand trial. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reported on what is required of the government when it comes to public input. It's not always straightforward.
The controversy among Laurel residents is how the state picked their city for the forensic mental health facility and why they didn't have a chance to comment on that choice. The state had been considering Billings, but asked communities to express interest after initial pushback last fall. According to a letter from Laurel City Administrator Kurt Markigard to the state, the city never applied because there wasn't suitable property in city limits. Markigard did point to land outside of city limits, but noted the state would need to go through the annexation process. The state then selected Laurel in early December. Markigard and city council members have said they were surprised by the decision and first heard about it in the press. Montana Board of Investments Director Dan Villa apologized for that surprise during a December meeting. BOI is charged with developing the facility.
That process could have been and indeed should have been handled better.
Villa promised more transparency as the process moved forward. The State Health Department, in a statement to MTPR, said it has kept the city government up to date and is also committed to transparency. In mid-January, the state found a potential site outside of the city. That's when public opposition really began. Residents have accused the state of not including the public in the site selection. But what's required of the state in this case isn't crystal clear, says Constance Van Clay, University of Montana law professor. There are two basic legal principles at play. One is the right to know.
So the right to know is the right to see what the government is doing, both by looking at their documents and also by watching them deliberate in meetings.
Then there's the right to participate.
The right to participate is actually an affirmative right to get to have your voice heard by agencies before they make a final decision.
That phrase, final decision, is particularly important in this instance. The BOI had public meetings about the facility. State health officials also presented to state lawmakers during meetings where the public could comment. Then there's the state's annexation application, which will go before Laurel officials. Local residents will be able to comment during that process.
At least to some extent, there has been some public process up through this point.
University of Montana law professor Mitch Werbel says there isn't enough case law to make an easy distinction of what constitutes a final decision by the government in this case. Van Clay agrees. She adds the state providing more chances for Laurel residents to comment might have been a good idea.
It's inconsistent with the spirit of the law for people to be blindsided by major decisions that will affect them.
The state's application to annex property for the new mental health facility into Laurel is forthcoming. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
In Wyoming, the Senate is considering a bill to prohibit a substance called kratom. It's often marketed as an herbal supplement, but it has addictive and psychoactive qualities similar to opioid drugs. Senator Bill Landon of Casper is sponsoring the bill. He said he's heard from multiple county coroners that the drug has been in the systems of suicide victims.
And I regret to tell you, senators, that here in Laramie County, the coroner here has identified the first victim of an overdose of this product.
Landon originally proposed regulating kratom products and setting an age limit, but he said the more he's learned about it, the more convinced he's become that it should be banned. The bill next heads to the Senate Appropriations, then to the Senate floor for two more votes. In Montana, lawmakers have so far tried and failed to pass regulations for kratom products, which remain available at gas stations, specialized tea bars, and smoke shops. Legislators are working on draft legislation for 2027. Montana is one of a shrinking number of states that doesn't have a law regulating student cell phone use in school. Research increasingly suggests the devices play a role in rising rates of anxiety, depression, and distractedness in kids. Some schools are taking matters into their own hands. They're taking input from students along the way. Montana PBS reporter Hannah Kears joined Montana Public Radio's Austin Amestoy to discuss the trend.
Hannah, the debate over student cell phone use in schools is not new, but it is starting to heat up in Montana and beyond. So where did you go to get an idea about what those conversations look like in schools?
So I went to Bozeman Schools to talk about their phone policy, and I was interested in seeing what they were doing because they're in this in-between time where their current phone policy is going to end this semester, and next school year, it's going to be a more restrictive phone policy.
Tell me about that transition. What does it look like now, and what are they moving toward?
So right now, high schoolers in Bozeman can use their phones during non-instructive periods. That's like lunch and passing periods. But next year, the phone policy is going to include those times to restrict cell phone use for students.
Interesting. How has Bozeman gone about crafting this policy? Who are the stakeholders?
Bozeman really came to this phone policy looking at it from student mental health and well-being. That is the broader goal of it. Cell phone policies is one pillar of that goal. And they put together a work group of 16 people, including administrators, students, parents, teachers, community partners, to learn more about the links of cell phones and student mental health.
So students were part of that working group. That's really interesting. Did you get a chance to speak to any of them?
Yes, I spoke with Taylor Truden in her Ceramics 2 class. Taylor is a senior and the class president. She was also one of the members of that work group.
I think it's really important that we take away the phones, not only for the academic aspect. I think a lot of the district employees really focused on the academic aspect and kids not being distracted by their phones. But I think as students really focused on the social aspect of it, like even just in the hallways and talking, when kids are on their phone, they're not communicating and they're not connecting with each other.
And there is a growing body of research that backs up what Taylor is saying there. And I understand, Hannah, you spoke with University of Montana psychologist Rachel Severson. How does her research play into this story?
Her work focuses on the developmental stage of our brains, those teenage years, where she says research has shown clear benefits is in an academic setting. So taking the cell phones out of the classroom, there's clear benefits to reducing that distraction. Even having your phone on silent can be a cognitive drain. Where things got a little mixed bag of evidence was the impacts that restricting or reducing cell phone use has on students' mental health.
Some evidence suggesting that it is benefiting kids, you know, improving their mental well-being because they're not having that chatter that is then bleeding over into the face-to-face interactions, and that it's increasing well-being as a result. However, the kids themselves are reporting that they feel worse.
There are going to be administrators listening to this conversation, I'm sure, Hannah, who are going through a similar discussion right now in their school. So from your experience, what makes for the crafting of a successful cell phone policy in schools? What sort of things should they be doing?
I'm not an expert at what's going to work and what's going to fail. But some of the things that I've been talking with administrators and districts and psychologists about is including the students in the policy and making the policy goes a long way of figuring out how it's going to be successful.
Montana PBS reporter Hannah Kears joining us today. Hannah, thank you for your reporting.
Well, thank you so much.
Last summer, the White House cut a $7 billion program to build residential solar in low-income communities. That's had a devastating impact on Native American tribes in Montana. Laura Hatch with Big Sky Connection has this report.
The Chippewa Cree on the Rocky Boy Reservation in northern Montana were part of a tribal coalition slated to get money from the Solar for All program. The tribe's Joseph Eagleman says it would have slashed high electricity bills for 200 families on the reservation, and losing it was a gut punch.
It was terrible. It sucked. There's 14 tribes that were on this coalition. We were just one of them. We weren't the only ones feeling it.
The coalition won a $135 million grant in 2024 through Solar for All, which was funded by the Biden-era Inflation Reduction Act. That money would have given each reservation about $7.6 million to build residential solar. Applicants on the rural reservation showed Eagleman their utility bills, some as high as $900 a month, and they were excited to get solar power to reduce their bills. The Trump administration cut Solar for All last summer after the budget bill rescinded funding for it. This story was produced with original reporting from Alana Newman for the Daily Yonder. I'm Laura Hatch reporting.
And it's been quite a week in sports for the region. Jalen Kopp won one more Olympic medal last week, and the Western Wyoming athlete secured a silver in the head-to-head event known as Dual Moguls. Jackson Hole Public Radio's Jenna McMurtry watched it live from the Kopp family's bar and filed this report from Tetonia, Idaho.
Around 40 people turned out to the Tetonia Club for a 2:30 a.m. watch party. Jalen Kopp crashed in the second-to-last round, and the hometown crowd thought all was lost. The 29-year-old from Alta took a full tumble before getting back on her feet. Then, her competitor skied off the course. That meant Kopp still advanced to the gold medal round. Family friend Beth Bird saw it all happen in real time, across the globe from the watch party back home.
Of course, we've loved to see her get a gold medal, but we know that she's so happy to have that silver medal too. So anytime that she's on the podium, we're happy.
This is Coff's second silver medal of the week and the third in her career. The Grand Targhee Resort athlete is now the most decorated U.S. Olympian in moguls. I'm Jenna McMurtry, KHOL News.
As we mentioned earlier in the Weekend Worm, the snow and lack of it has affected a lot of what's going on in the area. In Bozeman, it's caused the Collegiate Skiing Championships to change locations. The NCAA announced in a Tuesday news release the 2026 National Collegiate Skiing Championships have relocated to Utah Olympic Park for the Alpine events and the Soldier Hollow Nordic Center for the Nordic events. That's March 11th through the 14th in Park City, Midway, Utah, with the University of Utah as the host school. The event was scheduled to be hosted by Montana State at Bridger Bowl Ski Area and the Crosscut Mountain Sports Center. The NCAA said the move was made due to the lack of snow in the Bozeman area, and the Division I Cabinet Subcommittee approved the new host site. Utah has already been selected to host the 2028 National Collegiate Skiing Championships, and they will host the Winter Olympics in 2034. And from here in Billings, Rocky Mountain College men's basketball team has made a big jump in the latest coaches poll. The National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, or NAIA, Men's Basketball Coaches Top 25 National Poll has Rockies Battlin' Bears moved up from number 23 in the poll from late January. They're in a tie now at number 11 with Indiana's Bethel University in the poll. Rocky is the only Frontier Conference team in the recent top 25. The Battlin' Bears have a 13-game win streak and sit atop of the Frontier Conference with an 18-2 conference record and a 23-3 record overall. Rocky has two games left in the regular season, both on the road. Next week, Rocky Mountain is one of seven conference teams headed to the Frontier Conference postseason tournament at the Butte Civic Center. Stories we're continuing to follow include: President Donald Trump has nominated an executive from a hospitality company as director of the National Park Service. The nominee has extensive contracts with the agency he would lead. The nomination of Scott Socia late Wednesday follows widespread firings within the Park Service under plans by the Republican administration to sharply reduce its size. The Park Service also faces blowback for the removal or planned removal under Trump of park exhibits about slavery, climate change, and the destruction of Native American culture. Socia is a president for Parks and Resorts at Buffalo, New York-based Delaware North, which describes itself as one of the world's largest privately owned hospitality and entertainment companies, with more than $4 billion in revenue in 2022. The company provides services in at least six national parks, including Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and Shenandoah. Also developing this week, although some 2026 candidates had been campaigning for months, the official resignation period opened this week. Montana Public Radio's Shaley Rigger reported political hopefuls have 2 weeks to turn in their paperwork.
The first day of the candidate filing period is an important checkpoint during election season. The ability to file through the Montana Secretary of State's website means the wait to register in person is shorter than it used to be. Secretary of State Kristi Jacobson reported that Republican U.S. Senator Steve Daines was the first candidate to submit his paperwork for his reelection bid. Daines, who's seeking a third term in the Senate, filed online. Newly appointed state representative Katie Firethunder, a Bozeman Democrat, filed for office in Helena on Tuesday for the first time. She's campaigning to retain the seat she was appointed to after a former legislator resigned midterm.
This is a big day. This is to put my name on the ballot, and I think that is something that I didn't really think I ever imagined myself doing. But I think the moment we're in is calling for people to step up.
Montanans will vote for their representatives in the state legislature, Congress, the Public Service Commission, the Montana Supreme Court, and various local offices this year. The filing period ends March 4th, and the primary election is on June 2nd. In Helena, I'm Shaley Rieger.
And in another developing story, as three Montana protesters arrested last fall reached a plea deal, they're sending a message about immigration enforcement. Laura Hatch with Big Sky Connection has more.
Border Patrol agents detained a mother and her 17-year-old daughter from Flathead Valley, Montana, last September after a traffic accident. Protesters gathered at the Whitefish Border Patrol station that night to try to stop the agency from sending the pair to an ICE detainment facility. Leonette Galaz, Flathead Democracy Director, stepped in front of a Border Patrol truck she believed was carrying the detained pair as it was leaving the facility. Whitefish police arrested Galaz and two other protesters the next morning. She says it was worth it.
For a mom and her daughter to be taken into custody and then transferred to an ICE detention facility was a big enough issue, an important enough issue for us to put our bodies in front of a car at great risk to ourselves, understanding that we would be arrested.
Galaz and two other protesters, Colton Little and Aggie Putnam, will plead guilty at today's hearing to obstructing a peace officer and public nuisance. They'll serve a six-month deferred sentence and pay around $700 in fines. Lucia Torres and her daughter, Fergie Diaz, are originally from Honduras and were transferred to the Dilley Immigration Processing Center in Texas. Galaz says they've been released and are awaiting action on their asylum case. I'm Laura Hatch, reporting.
And we'll wrap on a positive note for the news spectrum. Eastern Montana is getting PBS programming over the TV airwaves for the first time. Montana PBS in October of last year closed a deal to purchase KYUS-TV, Miles City, KXGN-TV, Glendive, and K13-IGD, a translator relaying TV signal in Sydney, according to a news release from Montana State University. These small market commercial stations were offered for sale by the Marks Group following the death of owner Stephen Marks in 2022. Commercial broadcasters passed on buying the stations because the small market sizes would not have been sufficiently profitable, according to Montana PBS director Aaron Pruitt. In 2023, Marks Group offered the stations to Montana PBS. Pruitt says the conversion of commercial public TV stations to non-commercial educational license is extremely rare in the broadcasting industry. Pruitt says the process took years of negotiations, engineering studies, real estate acquisitions, FCC approvals, and a vote by the Montana University Systems Board of Regents. PBS programming on the three stations went live this month. That's the Weekend Worm for the final week of February 2026. We'll have another episode of The Worm Monday, and we'll keep the weekend editions coming, too. I'm Carl Lengel. Have a great weekend.
The Worm is a production of Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Metal art call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.